Jessica Mitford did all of us a tremendous service with her expose of the graveyard ghouls, the American way of death. It showed what a casket and interment-worshipping nation we've become, with all the attendant vampirism of money-sucking on the part of those black-suited swine who cajole us when our darkest hours of misery are at hand. For the record, and just so my wonderful middle-class Jewish relatives won't have their way with my poor mortal coil once I've shucked it off, be it herewith known before all and sundry that being of sound mind and body, I want the cheapest funeral imaginable. One of those $1.98 jobbies with the cardboard casket. Then after the closed-lid ceremony, at which I want only my enemies in attendance, I see no need to make my friends suffer the peculiar tortures of watching someone they've loved lying there about ready to become worm food, kindly sell off my eyeballs and my bones and my skin and anything else medical science can use to help somebody else, and send the proceeds to either the deacons down south to buy some guns, or to the St. Labre Indian Mission to buy those redskin kids some decent clothes. And that, friends and lovers, is the final dispensation of my mortal remains on this earth. And let Tutankhamun have nothing on me. This be my curse. If any schmuck defies this decree and my body be laid out in all the grotesque finery of the undertaking cosmetic art, with weepers and wailers and necrophiles surrounding, so that my headstone is finally set to read, "Nothing in his life became him as much as the leaving of it," then may all those involved in this perfidy be condemned to the deepest stratum of hell, in which they will roast forever, and be compelled to read, over and over and over, till time doubles back on itself and starts again, my condemnation of the funereal society, "We mourn for anyone." It had been the work of perhaps a minute and a half to kill his wife. Gordon Vernon stepped back from the edge of the roof, out of the line of sight from the building across the way. Deliberately, he began to puddle the weapon. The weapon was a small, knobbed box. It had cost him $10,000, and the man who had constructed it had, luckily, been outdrawn in a duel the month before. The box's sole function was the emission of a beam which affected the semicircular canals of the inner ear, the canals which govern the balance of the body. The little box canceled this function. It was ingenious, and Vernon was thankful he had seen to the duel which had killed the inventor. The man might have wanted to patent the device someday, and that would have been fatal. The only person, as a consequence, who knew of the existence of the little box was Gordon Vernon, and he was destroying it, for it had served its sole purpose. It had foolproofedly murdered his wife. The little box, with its protruding dials and thin wire antenna, began to slag away into molten nothingness under the controlled heat of his flamer. He kept the beam on the box, which lay on the plasteel roof of the building, making certain the heat was enough to melt the weapon, but not enough to char the plasteel. In a few moments, the box had been reduced to a shining flat wafer of fused metal. The sun's light caught a plane of the surface and reflected brightly in Vernon's blue eyes. He holstered the flamer, making certain to set the air wick in the barrel cleanser to spray, cleaning away all evidence that the flamer had been fired. Then he stooped and picked up the wafer of metal. He carried it to the opposite side of the building. Scaling it like a plastic plate, he threw it out over the city. He saw it arc down between the towering pastel-tinted buildings and disappear onto a side street. The refuse max would dispose of it in, he looked at his ring watch, about 3/4 of an hour. Then all evidence would be gone. The perfect murder had been tastefully committed. Vernon walked swiftly to the drop shaft and lowered to the 70th floor of the building. From there, he took the seldom used escalator down the back way and, 7 minutes later, was on the street. A crowd had already gathered across the street in front of his building. He looked across at the building he had just left, up to where he had stood, and was reassured that no one in his own building could have seen him. The crowd was deepening, but he didn't join it. Several uniformed legalizers were forming an arm-locked circle trying to keep the crowd away. He already knew what was in the center of that throng. Lisa. Dead from a 96-story fall. Quite dead. And by his hand. But ostensibly dead from an accidental fall. He had committed the perfect murder simply by jamming the balancing faculty of his wife's inner ear. When the kill box had negated her sense of balance, she had left her roof garden luncheon party precipitously, over the parapet and down to the street. The giving plastic of the streets was constructed to give ease to walking, but from the height Lisa had fallen, it was as stone hard as steel. He walked past the crowd disinterestedly, as a man would who was returning from work and had no time for idle street gawking. As he passed, a woman turned and called to him almost hysterically. He recognized her as one of the women Lisa had invited to the roof luncheon. The old ghoul must have dropped down that shaft like a greased pig to see the mess, he thought wryly.
Mr. Vernon! Mr. Vernon, your wife! Your wife! She's...
The woman's face was pasty white and she seemed to be clogging on her own tongue, yet there was an unnatural gleam in her eyes. The old bat enjoys the sight of death, I do believe, Vernon added mentally. The woman couldn't let the rest of her sentence fall, but she had served her purpose. Vernon let a look of terror and disbelief course across his square, almost handsome features. He ran to the crowd and elbowed through. There in the center, sprawled crazily, worse than he had thought it could possibly be, was Lisa. It wasn't a very pleasant way to end your little affair, Liz, darling, he thought with finality. But I've never much cared for unfaithful wives. They seem so tediously melodramatic. My God, what happened? Gordon Vernon screamed, falling to his knees in the street, burying his face and hands in the crumpled, bloody shape. Before his view was cut off, he saw the faces of the people. The crowd breathed tragedy and condolences for him. Vernon's flamer clattered in its sheath against the sidewalk as he writhed. No one noticed. I've got to get that sheath oiled, he thought clearly. And I'd better hire a mourner, too. It had been a good day. After the brief inquest and after the coroner had clicked its decision, flashing death by accident on its view slit, Gordon Vernon had begun his show of sorrow. It wasn't strictly protocol. He might have already hired himself a mourner and left the chore to him, but Vernon was a cautious man, and laying it on a little heavier could do no harm. It was annoying to have to look woeful about Liz's demise, but he knew it wouldn't last long, just till those surly members of her family that had attended the inquest were appeased. They were duelers, those Selmans. They would duel on a moment's provocation, and they were all crack shots. It was easier just to look bereaved than to worry whether one of them had been insulted. It wasn't a bad day at all, and he left the inquest as soon as possible after making arrangements for the funeral. I have to hire a mourner, the very best in the city, he told friends, and caught the icy stare of the Selman family. They had never liked him. They were certain he had married Liz for her money, and they would have been right, of course, and that he was no good. But there was nothing they could do. There was no suspicion that Liz had committed suicide out of unhappiness. It seemed to be an accident. But right now, his primary concern was hiring a mourner, particularly with those dual crazy Selmans around. If they thought there was any slightest breach of etiquette on his part, there would be a stand as sure as he lived. He had to find the very best mourner available. A good mourner was important, not only because he was too busy to mourn himself, but just because it wasn't done anymore. The proper thing to do, and the thing to do if you didn't want the Mourner's Guild picketing the funeral, was hire the most expensive one his accounts would allow and let the black-cloaked mourner do the job. It was a sign of being well-to-do. It was the accepted thing to do. And it took the tiresome and time-wasting strain of mourning, a lost one, from the bereaved. How in the world they ever got along getting upset, wasting time, energy, and emotion mourning their own dead before the guild is something I'll never understand, Gordon Vernon mused, as he flagged a flit cab outside the courts building. Third level, professional block 88, building A, he snapped at the flit man, settling back as the cab lifted to its outbound slot in the streams of traffic. Who should I engage for the funeral? It had to be a well-known mourner, for the Vernons were a well-known family. Both the Vernon and Selman standards flew in the titled family group at the Dualarama, and it had to be one who would do a top-notch job, chest-beating and histrionics, if at all possible, because he couldn't take a chance on one of the Selmans being insulted. If they thought their little Lisa had been slighted at her own funeral, they would cast the glove for a duel, surely. Gordon Vernon had several mourner friends in his own circle of acquaintances. Should he hire Ralph Moody Benoit? Ralph had been one of the mourners engaged for the big war rally funeral pyre in the Dualarama 3 months before, to raise funds for the Aldebaran War. No, Ralph was too slow building. He started out with a perfectly normal speaking voice and clapping of hands, and while he personally preferred this more restrained type of mourning, Vernon knew the Selmans would expect something much more flamboyant. No, tears were slow in coming to Ralph. No, he couldn't chance it with Moody Benoit. What about Alistair Chubb? No, too much saccharin for this job. Sincerity, but with high emotional content and a great deal of semantically charged hysterics. Those were the keynotes this time. He had to have Flipman. Change that. I don't want to go to my office. Instead, second level residential office block 14, building M. Certainly. Why hadn't he thought of Maurice Silvera before this? Why bother with all the piddlers and three-shot funeral boys when Silvera was a close friend of the family, when he could have the great Silvera mourn at his wife's funeral? Maurice Silvera, M.O.D., a longtime friend of the Vernons and acknowledged the top mourner in the country. He would draw on their friendship to get Silvera's services, and perhaps lower the rate a bit. Is your phone tagged in? He asked over the partition. The flitman nodded his head briskly, and Gordon Vernon pulled the receiver from its stick plate, dialed Weschler 992084K. There were a few moments waiting till the machines hooked their beams in connection, and the viewplate turned reflective during that time. Vernon stared at his reflection in the mirror of the viewplate and realized he had a good many years ahead of himself. With Lisa out of the way, and with his good looks and determination, there were no heights to which he could not aspire. His hair was a sandy brush cut, with the current stylistic sliver of silver slashing vertically to the widow's peak above his high forehead. His eyes were a deep blue that seemed to pulse when he stared at them too closely. His mouth was firm and his nose just off-center enough to prevent any hint of femininity. He was, indeed, a good-looking man, and Liz had not been the only woman in the city. There were 8 flashes before Silvera lifted the receiver at his end. The viewplate remained mirrored.
Good afternoon. I can't see you. Would you tag in your view, please?
Vernon pressed at the view stud, but the plate remained blank.
Flipman, what's the matter with your view? Is it dead?
The flipman half turned his head, shrugged his shoulders, and replied, Don't know, Mac. This is a replacement flit. Must be bunco. Sorry.
Maurice, this is Gordon Vernon, he answered brightly. I'm in a flit on my way over to your office. The view's out, but it doesn't matter. I just wanted to make certain you were in. Can you spare me a half hour?
The rich baritone voice of the mourner came back clearly.
Why, certainly, Gordon. Any time. I'm free till 6. What do you want, a vodka-tini or a straight high scotch?
The high scotch will be fine, Maurice. Have it warmed for me. Be there in 10.
Fine. See you.
Pippo.
Pip.
Then he blanked off. Vernon restuck the receiver and slumped back in the flit cab's cushions. It had started out slowly today, but things were moving rather nicely now. He had had to look sorrowful for a while there, which had been an unaccustomed strain, but soon he could dump all that tedious routine work in Silvera's capable hands. The whole thing had worked out so beautifully, He wondered why he hadn't done it sooner. If you can't find the man she's been sleeping around with, then you nip the evil at its very source, he thought, sucking a cigar alight. Gordon Vernon had known for some time that Liz was cheating on him, but there hadn't been anything he could do, nor did he want to do anything. He had married Liz for her money and her position, and now that he had them, he was quite willing to let her tramp around to her heart's content. It kept her out of the way effectively and let him pursue career or other companionship with equal ease. But then the offers of presidency for Titano Aluminium had come up, and he knew they would screen much too carefully to allow his name to be muddied by Liz's ill-timed infidelity. A scandal would puncture any chances for the appointment. So he had tried to discover them in the act, to let blame fall where it should and let himself get out from under unbesmirched. He had failed. The man, whoever he was being cautious and clever about the clandestine meetings. When he had confronted Liz with it, she had screamed at him, laughed raucously, thrown things, threatened to give the expose to the confidentials for publication. That was when he had decided the presidency was more important than the harpy tramp he had married. So he had killed her. And the presidency of Titano Aluminium was within his very grasp. Just a mourner and the funeral? I won't be able to attend that. A preparatory board meeting of TA, more important. Oh well, the mourner usually handles it solo without help from the surviving members of the family anyhow. And then the screening clearance for the appointment. He sank into the flit cab's cushions, dragged deeply on his cigar, and smiled at the sky slit of the flit cab. Somewhere up there, Liz had met her maker. There had been a hasty stand on the landing deck when the flit cab landed. One man accusing another of denting his flit's fender, an argument and a besmirching of character. Vernon had paid the flitman and watched interestedly for a few minutes. They both seemed to be inept with their flamers, and he always enjoyed watching a pair of fools make bigger fools of themselves. He stood at cross angles to their line of flame with the rest of the crowd and watched the two men go through the ritual. The insulted party cast the glove by slapping the insulter's face. A red four-pronged flush appeared on the insulter's face, and he demanded, "When, where, what weapons?" The insulted party answered sharply, "Here, now, flamers." They glared at one another for a moment, backed to back, and a legalizer who had arrived shortly after the beginning of the argument paced them off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, he counted off, keeping his eyes steadied to make certain none of the crowd had strayed into the line of flame. 8, 9, 10, he paused. "Turn!" Both men spun awkwardly, and the insulted clutched for his sheath. He was an instant too slow, and the insulter's hand-slapped fabric came away with the blue-steeled flamer in his palm, and a spray of livid orange flame boiled straight line for the insulted. But the shot was a hasty one. It grazed the insulted, charring his left shoulder, crackling the fabric of his suit, and tossing the man sidewise. The insulted had his own weapon out, and the next shot, free and clear, was his. He steadied himself, slapping at the sparks on his suit, and a slow grin came over his face. Clods, Vernon thought. They'd both be dead were they dueling the Selmans or myself. Then, at the realization of the ability he had acknowledged on Liz's family's part, he tensed and watched the duel more closely, trying to get those damned relatives from his mind. The insulted brought his flamer up, and the insulter quivered slightly as the gun came to rest on a line with his stomach. At least the fool knows enough to go for the vitals. The shot roared from the bell mouth of the gun and caught the insulter high in the chest. It had been bad aim, and the man's face was washed by a sheet of flame. He screamed high and pitched over, the flames licking up and around, charring his skin, burning off his hair. He lay there whimpering for a few seconds, then settled quietly. Following the ritual terms, the insulted was over to him quickly, beating out the flames with his own cape. Then he turned the dead man over, carefully avoiding looking at the ruined face, and extracted the man's ident from his ring watch. He handed the ident, along with several bills from his own pouch, to the legalizer, adding, "If this doesn't cover the cost of a mourner and funeral, have his surviving members ring me at this number." He handed the legalizer a slip of printed paper and walked away. As the insulted's flit took off, Vernon sneered in derision. The clown? The unmitigated clown, pompous ass, walks away as though he'd really defended his honor. What would he have done if he'd been forced to face a real gun? Then, abruptly, he dragged himself back to the matter at hand. He walked to the dropshaft banks. The dropshaft lowered him to Silvera's corridor, and he found the apartments without difficulty. The door louvered open at his approach. He let the servo mech take his cloak and let it unbuckle his gun belt, making certain the flamer was on safety. Never can be too sure with these servo mechs. Maurice Silvera, professional mourner, was waiting in the music cubicle. A tape of Delibes' Sylvia was sending soft harmonies through the room baffles. The music seemed to be emerging from the air next to Vernon's ear. Silvera rose to greet his guest. The mourner was a tall man, at least a full head taller than Vernon, with a high-combed mat of silver-gray hair. His nose was thin and aquiline, and his face held breeding. He was a handsome man by any standards, but not superciliously handsome. There was a certain humanity in his appearance, strange to be found in one of his occupation. He had been Liz Vernon's lover. Silvera walked smoothly to the room opening and took Vernon's hand. "Gordon, how nice to see you again. When was the last? Oh, yes, at the bearskin party Liz threw. Marvelous." He smiled at Vernon, and the visitor renewed his liking for the tall mourner. Silvera had been a family friend for several years, though they got together seldom, and Vernon had always enjoyed the man's company. He wasn't like the other mourners, with their predilection for death and its trappings. There was a certain gaiety to him, and a jocularity of speech that belied his profession. Abruptly, Vernon remembered this was not a social call, it was a business call, so accordingly he used the mourner ritual. "Will you mourn in my behalf?" he asked Silvera seriously, using the accepted colloquial form of the ancient mourner phrases. Silvera's dark eyes widened momentarily at the words. He had thought this was a pleasure visit. He responded instantly, however, following the prescribed rune. "We mourn for anyone. Will you convey my heart? We will share your sorrow. Will you save my agony? We will shed your tears." They both sat down and Vernon continued, "How will you mourn my lost one?" Silvera answered in tones of utter sincerity, though he must have spoken this formula 1,000 times. "With the honor of the dead, with the love and sincerity of the living, with the sorrow of the bereaved, with the glory of the upraised." He pressed a stud on the tabletop beside his relaxer and a cigarette came up through a tube, already alight. He took it and drew deeply, watching Gordon Vernon carefully, tensing for the answer to his next question. Vernon asked, "What must I pay for your services?" "Who has died?" Silvera tensed, hoping. Vernon licked his lips. "My wife has died." There was no indication of changing mood on the mourner's placid face, but he took a sharp, stinging drag on the cigarette. "I'll have to emote you." Vernon's eyes narrowed. This was a departure from the ritual. "Is that necessary?" The mourner spread his hands. "In cases where there is a close tie to the deceased, the only way we can gauge our rates, provide the very best service, is to emote you." Vernon knew how the mourners worked. They used their emotion counter on the bereaved and gauged exactly how much sorrow he held. If it was substantially lower than what decorum might demand for a widow or widowers, the mourner made up in added effort what the bereaved lacked in reality. And they charged accordingly. There didn't seem to be any other way, so Vernon agreed. Silvera led him from the music cubicle, walking stiffly erect, and they went into the office portion of the mourner's combined office home. He pressed the stud on his desk console, and the emoter slid free from its hidden cubicle in the wall. It was a large, ball-shaped chair with a special sensitive pad covering it. The pad was sticky and adhered to the body of the subject. It connected itself with the nerve ends in the body, giving a true reading on the dials and meters set into the control panel.
"Strip," Silvera said.
Gordon Vernon hurriedly shucked his clothing, piling it unceremoniously on the desk console. His one-piece suit unstuck in a second, and he removed his jump boots with equal ease. The insulating layer under his clothing came off next, and he stood naked in the office.
"Sit down, please," Silvera said, adding in a friendly tone, "Gordon."
Vernon slumped into the chair, and instantly he could feel the sticky pad clamp itself to his flesh. It made goose pimples rise on his skin, but he sat very still while the machine hummed softly beneath him. In a few moments, Silvera slapped him on the shoulder.
"That's it. I've gotten a good reading."
Vernon stood up, the pad unsticking sharply with a vague sucking sound, and redressed. He pulled a fresh cigar from his pouch and drew it to a red coal at its tip.
"Well, what's the reading?" he inquired curiously.
"Let's go back into the music room," Silvera suggested lightly. "We can be more comfortable out of this air of business. After all, we are friends."
"But business is business," Vernon reminded with a grin.
Silvera's smile was strained, but Vernon didn't notice.
"Yes, that's right. Business certainly is business."
They returned to the music cubicle and sank back into their relaxers.
"Well?" Vernon inquired.
"You must pay me standard mourner rates plus $200 an hour overtime." Vernon sat up abruptly.
"What? That's the most exorbitant price I've ever..."
Silvera leaned forward, stared intently into Vernon's face.
"Gordon, my patient and polite manner extends far outside these walls. What happens in here goes no further. But let's be perfectly frank with one another."
"What do you mean?"
"Gordon, I've been reading emotion charts for 13 years now as a licensed and practicing MOD. In all that time, I've never seen an emotor reading lower than yours."
"Well, what does that signify?" Vernon was nervous now. He twisted the cigar between unsteady fingers.
"It means you aren't sorry Liz is gone."
Vernon's face flushed and he sputtered.
Why, that's just ridiculous. Of course I'm sorry, Liz. Well, I've never heard anything. You may be a great mourner, Silvera, but this is..."
Silvera remained calm and steady.
"Gordon, I know my business. To handle this funeral, I'd really have to generate to make up for your total lack of bereavement. That means a considerable drain on my emotion drugs, a great deal of time and preparation, the hiring of a good sorrow writer, and a lot of incidentals the average man knows nothing about. My price is quite fair, Gordon. If you had a bit more sorrow in you, the price would have been lower."
He was finished, and it was obvious that arguing would get nowhere. These mourners were not fish peddlers to be talked down in price. What they said was what they said, and since they had tied up the field with the guild, what they said stuck. It wasn't the usual procedure, and much more than Vernon had considered putting into the funeral, but since he had decided it was safest to throw a big funeral for Liz, those belligerent Selmans would have to be pacified. The total would come close to $4,000, but it would be worth the outrageous fee if the mourning was done properly. Vernon agreed inside himself, and reluctantly fell back into the ritual.
"I agree to your terms, mourner. Then mourn for me."
The ritual was concluded, and they settled back in their relaxers. The conversation lost its echo of authority and settled into a more relaxed, but still tense tone.
"Look, Maurice," Vernon began, "perhaps I'd better explain about Liz and myself.
Silvera tried to stop him with,
"That isn't necessary at all, Gordon. My professional standing doesn't demand a thing, and as a friend of the family, you don't have to tell me, unless you want to."
"No, no, I want to tell you," Vernon resumed hurriedly, "so you'll understand why my emotor reading was low."
Silvera listened intently. Liz was keeping time with someone else. She'd been cheating on me for quite a while now.
Silvera asked carefully, "Have you any idea who the man was?"
He waited tightly.
"None," Vernon replied, shaking his head. "But that's why Liz and I weren't close at all, why I have no sorrow at her going. We've been like strangers to one another for over a year."
He looked sad, but Silvera knew there was no sorrow in the man.
Silvera looked concerned. "How did she die, Gordon?"
Gordon Vernon looked infinitely sad for a moment, then replied,
"She was holding a luncheon party for her club on the roof garden. I was out at the time. One of the women at the inquest testified she was carrying a tray past the parapet wall. It's very low and ornamental, right around the tables there, you know. And she screamed and fell over."
"How horrible."
"Yes, yes, yes," he said with weariness. "Even though she wasn't true and we had our fights, I'm afraid I'll miss Liz a great deal. Basically, Maurice, she was a fine woman. A dirty tramp cheat is more like it," he added bitterly.
They talked a while longer, Silvera through his pleasant conversation, overcoming Vernon's annoyance at the extra high tariff on his services. Then Vernon begged leave, paid Silvera by scripto check, and allowed the door to louver open for him.
"Well, pip-ho, Maurice, and do your very best at the funeral."
"Pip, Gordon, and I certainly will."
Vernon drop-shafted up to the roof, where he flagged a flit cab, while down Building M, down in apartments 554 to 559, Maurice Silvera, M.O.D., was sitting with eyes dark and clouded. He bit the flesh of his fist till the marks were left there in sharp relief. Then he rose, carefully tore the scripto check into 100 pieces, and systematically fed the shredded bits of paper to his incin tray. Cursing Gordon Vernon for the murder of Liz Vernon, the woman he had loved in secret, and swearing he would even the score with Vernon. Yes. He would certainly do the best he could at the funeral.
No one would tell Gordon Vernon, for it would be a mark of social inelegance to bring a thing like that to a man's attention. No one would tell him that the mourner, masked and caped, had done a rotten, a shameful job of grieving. No one would tell him of the scene Liz's relatives, the dual crazy Salmons, had made. No one would tell him how they had raved at the mourner's show of no sorrow, how they had stamped about and thrown down the bowers of flowers, calling, "Sacrilege! Sacrilege! Duel!" No one would tell him, because it was obvious. The mourner had no personal interest in the funeral. He was merely doing a job. He was merely reflecting the sorrow, by proportion, of the surviving family. If he had done a rotten job, it was obvious the reason was because Gordon himself had no sorrow at Liz's passing. It was an accepted thing. When a mourner did a bad job, for weren't they impartial and merely hired to do the job of spewing emotions, it was evident there had been no sorrow with which to work, basically, and no mourner would falsify his emoting. There had to be a point where they emoted truth. So the mourner did a bad, bad job, and the Selman's guns were out. No one would tell Gordon Vernon, but he knew something had gone wrong in his scheme. He knew it soon and suddenly.
"We all knew Liz never should have married you, Vernon. All of us knew you were a fortune hunter. Now she's dead, and you're going to pay for it."
The Selmans had come from Upper Pittsburgh, and there was still a New York State twang in their voices. They were an unpleasant family who had gotten rich quickly on ferromino oxides found on otherwise worthless property they owned.
Gordon Vernon had never cared for them, for they had bought their family's prestige, while the Vernon standard had been much respected for decades.
But I was nowhere near her when she fell, so why are you challenging me?
Rance Selman, the youngest son, stepped forward. His fame with Flamer and Jagknife was written up in all the cheap duelist periodicals, and Gordon Vernon prayed deep inside himself that the boy would not offer the challenge as a personal stand. He had seen too many hasty stands, such as the one the other day on Silvera's roof, and he knew he'd never have a chance in a fast draw contest. The boy's hand came up and around swiftly, cracking into Vernon's jaw, snapping the man's head around. Tears came to his eyes, and he stared as through a film at the tense-faced Selman boy.
Vernon, I'm calling it at you. I'm challenging you. When, where, what weapons?
Vernon swallowed, heard himself answering,
"The mall, tomorrow morning at 10, Flamers. And by God, you be there,"
the boy snapped, turning. As the Selmans left, there was the telltale hip movement of the boy that marked an accomplished gunsman, a crack-shot duelist. Vernon was dead, and he knew it.
Maurice! What happened at the funeral? What happened, Maurice? I've been challenged. The Selmans want to kill me. What happened, Maurice?
Vernon's face was a motley of sweat, and his hands shook as they wound in Maurice Silvera's velvet collar. Silvera brought his hands up sharply, knocking Vernon's clutching fingers away.
I'm afraid I wasn't very convincing, Vernon, old man. They don't think you regret Liz's death enough. They don't think you're sorrowful enough, so they want to increase your sorrow.
A faint tinge of smile gleamed on Silvera's handsome face.
I just wasn't very convincing.
You weren't what? You weren't convincing? Good God, Silvera, I paid you enough.
Yes, but you murdered Liz.
Vernon's mouth slid open, and his eyes glazed with the terror of the hunted. He stammered something unintelligible.
Yes. Yes, that's right,
Silvera answered in a perfectly normal, conversational tone.
I sentenced you to death. Liz and I talked about it many times. She was certain you'd tried to kill her if you found out about us.
You? Then it was...
That's right, Gordon. That's right.
You planned it all?
Silvera was nodding. He had just a moment to knock the flamer from Vernon's hand. He slapped Vernon twice, quickly, back and forth, and the sandy-haired man slumped down to a hassock, his breath beginning to come raggedly, a sob mounting in his chest.
My God, what will I do? What'll I do? He'll kill me. They'll be watching the areaways. I won't be able to get away. He'll burn me down. What'll I do?
Silvera smiled down at the murderer, his handsome face washed by unnamed emotions. Then he said something. Without waiting for the beginning of the ritual, he said,
"We mourn for anyone